Okay, good morning and welcome. Thank you for coming to this fourth week of the summer Shir series. This Sunday we have the great schus to have Rav Blau with us to share some Divrei Torah on Parshas Pinchas. Rav Blau, thank you very much.
I'd like to discuss three things, if I have time. And they deal with leadership, succession, and inheritance. So there's a common thread, at least. And it's going to deal with Pinchas, Yehoshua, and Bnos Tzlofcha. Obviously, there are other aspects of the parasha that I'm not going to say anything about. So I'm just going to quickly go over the initial psukim of the parasha to find out exactly how the Torah responds to the act of Pinchas, which is the end of last week's parasha, which we all heard on Shabbos, where Pinchas is the kanoi, the one who steps forward and kills Zimri ben Salo, Nisi Beisav, the Shimon, and the Midjan is Kozvi Vasur Roshumos Beisav, the Midjan, both of whose names first appear in Parshas Pinchas and are not mentioned explicitly in last week's Parsha. So, and he seems to act on his own, not under the direction of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a independent performance. So Pinchas, Hashem tells Moshe, Pinchas did a wonderful thing. He removed God's anger from the Jewish people because he zealously reflected the anger of HaKadosh Baruch Hu with them, and I didn't destroy the Jewish people in my anger. What is his reward? He gets a double reward. L'chein emor, ninino sein lo, es bisi shalom. First reward is he gets my covenant of peace, which on the surface is a strange reward. To give someone as a kanoi, you give him peace. We'll see various interpretations. And then v'hoitzelo l'zaro acharav bris kuhunas olam tachas shekinei l'eloka l'eloha v'chapeo b'nei Yisrael. And secondly, I'm going to give him and his descendants a covenant of permanent kuhuna, a priesthood. What exactly that means, that I'm giving him this bris, we'll see three interpretations. So let's start with the first. What does it mean he gives that Pinchas is going to get a covenant of peace? So there are two ways that one simply can understand it. And the Mefarshim, most of the early Mefarshim take the first, and that is that after all, he killed the leader of one of the tribes of Israel. The effect of killing someone is to produce anger on the family and the descendants of the person killed, and revenge will lead to revenge. Anger leads to anger. So therefore, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm giving him a bris of shalom, I'm giving him peace, a guarantee that no one is going to come out from Zimri's family to revenge his death. That's the simplest interpretation from the Mefarshim in the Rishon intend to say. The other interpretation, which is found in the Hamek Davar, reflects something quite earlier in the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin, Perek Tes Halacha Zayin, the Yerushalmi says in the ninth chapter, seventh Halacha, we tend not to use pages to describe Yerushalmi as we do with the Bavli, simply because there's no standard pagination. So if it's telling a page, it doesn't always help. You can pick up your shamit from the shelf and they have a different pagination, but they don't change the order of the parsh, of the prakim, of the chapters, or the halachas within the prakim. So that's an effective way of telling you where to find the Rishalmi. The Rishalmi says, Pinchas shelo b'tzon chachamim. That Pinchas' act was not approved by the chachamim. And in general, when the Gemara says something shelo b'tzon chachamim, it doesn't only mean that they didn't understand it, but it means they literally didn't approve of it. And it's very strange, it seems to go against everything that's said in the Pesukim. Right? The explanation most likely is that kanaras, zealousness, that causes one to act particularly without process, right? He just goes, kills him. He didn't go through a court system, acts immediately, is very dangerous. Because if everyone can make their own judgment who deserves to be killed, who deserves to be punished, without any kind of checking it out, going through a legal process, we're certainly going to have a very chaotic, anarchic society, and one which can be very dangerous and very problematic. That's one explanation. The second explanation is that in making the judgment that someone else deserves to die, that's a very profound decision, to put it mildly. And one has to be 100% sure that the person who makes that decision is doing so with a purity of mind and a clarity of purpose and doesn't have any other agenda whatsoever. And therefore it's a very dangerous kind of thing. So therefore one has to be very reluctant in supporting someone saying, I did it kanaras l'shem shamayim, right? We know that the people who call themselves the Kanaim often are people who go beyond control, and therefore it was only when Hashem said, I trust his motivation, the Rishalmi is quite explicit in that Hashem guaranteed that Pinchas was acting purely l'shem shamayim. He had no personal agenda. He wasn't looking for any rewards. He did it simply because it needed to be done, that he gets a reward. And what is the reward? That this quality of zealousness and anger not overwhelm him, but on the contrary, he get a covenant of peace. That it be balanced, because obviously it reflects a certain nature and personality, that it be balanced, then he'd be given harmony and peace. Hard to imagine the same person being the kanoi and being the harbinger of peace at the same time. And what's really interesting, of course, in the complexity of this, is that the description of his grandfather Aharon is that Aharon is the epitomization of a man of peace, right? The Oev Shalom, the Rode Shalom, the Osa Shalom and Mechaber, the one who goes out of his way to be peaceful and harmonious. If anything, at the time of the Chayta Egel, where his behavior was certainly questionable, Aaron's response was the opposite. He was not the Kanoi. He didn't take any chance. He was the peaceful one. Find a way, accommodate the people. He was the accommodator, which would seem to be almost the opposite of Pinchas. But clearly we need some balance of the two. Let us continue with the second part of this, with Brisi of Kunas Olam. So most people are familiar with Rashi, and Rashi is based on one view in the Gemara, which says that Pinchas' status was an anomaly. that when Aaron and his sons were given kahuna, the priesthood, for their descendants, that referred to the descendants who were going to be born. Pinchas had the problem that he was not in the list of Aaron and his sons because he was a grandson. His name is not mentioned. And at the same time, he already was born. So he's not included in those who are going to be caught, who are going to get it from then on. So he was the exception. And therefore, he and his descendants needed to be given separately kahuna, because it didn't come automatically because of the particular situation of when he was born. However, other mefarshim interpret it differently, and it has to do with different ways of understanding the word olam. Olam, which we translate as forever, as permanent, can have other meanings as well. Right? Va'avadol li olam, he's going to be his slave forever, doesn't mean forever. It means until yovel. La'olam can mean for a long time. Right? For a long time. Riskans. Olam for a long time. Olam could also refer to some permanence into the nature of the kahuna. So using these two additional interpretations, so one explanation that is given is that Pinchas simply lived a very long time. And he was a Kohen, la'olam, he was a Kohen for a long time. Long enough to be the Kohen Gadol, even the time of Yiftach. Unfortunately, from the Haftarah we just read recently, unfortunately, he doesn't come across extremely well in that story. Nevertheless, you make a calculation, it's a number of 100 years later. So he obviously had unusual longevity. So kunas olam can mean great longevity. And it gives also that story, unfortunately, that someone who is a great hero at one point in his life, that very quality can turn out to be a problem later on, because as Chazal understood the story of Yiftach and the tragedy of Yiftach's daughter, which he either did or didn't kill. Different interpretations, but the tragedy of the story is the unwillingness of Yiftach to go to Pinchas and Pinchas to go to Yiftach. Right? Yiftach was the one who was the military hero who saved the Jewish people. He thought that Pinchas should go to him, because he was the one who saved the day. On the other hand, Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol. Pinchas already saved the Jewish people much before him, hundreds of years before. He wouldn't go to Yiftach. So sometimes the reward of greatness and appreciation can go to one's head, and can produce a problem where one's ego gets somewhat inflated. And Chazal see Pinchas as falling into that trap later on. Still a third interpretation, that kahunas olam refers to kahuna gedola, the high priesthood. Because the high priest, Kohen Gadol, differs from the other Kohanim, and that he's sort of he functions as a Kohen all the time, in many ways. Most Kohanim, who are not an ordinary Kohen, so when he takes his big day kahuna off, and then he's not functioning in the Mikdash, he has the Yisurim of kahuna, but he's not a full-fledged Kohen. He's limited to what he can do. The Kohen Gadol is not allowed to leave the Mikdash. Why? Because he's always on as a Kohen. Right? The tzitz, which the Kohen Gadol wears on his forehead, is meratzeh. For tumah, it eliminates tumah even when the Kohen Gadol is not wearing it, because the Kohen Gadol is always a Kohen Gadol. So therefore, he's the Kohen Olam. He's the full-time Kohen. Not part-time, but always a Kohen in the fullest sense of the word. And the fact is that kahuna gedola was given to Pinchas and his descendants. The Kohen Olam could mean that they gave them that he always was a Kohen. But because he was always had been a Kohen doesn't guarantee he becomes a Kohen Gadol. Certainly not that his descendants are going to be always the Kohen Gadol. So go. Kuhunas Olam can mean the Kuhunu Gadol. So we have, just to summarize what we did up till now, we find with respect to Pinchas that he is rewarded by giving once the Bris of Shalom, which can be understood in two different ways. One as protection from the family of Zimri. He killed Zimri, maybe his family might want to take revenge. Therefore he's giving a God guarantee, peace that no one's going to harm him. Or it could refer to the fact that the quality that he expresses of Kanos is very volatile. It's one that's only appropriate on limited occasions and when one's motivation is totally pure. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him the balance of the covenant of peace. And so, HaMakdavas, you balance the Kanos with peace. Yeah.
I think HaMakdavas says also that the point of that, that the Shalom actually worked against him because he wasn't a Kanai at the time of Esalina.
That's true. That is true. That is true. It says you pay a price for every quality you have. Right? What Weiss pointed out was that the same HaMakdavas mentions that when there was another crisis in the time of Pesel Micha, when we would have expected Pinchas, the Kanoi, to express himself, that Kanoas had been diluted by giving the Shalom and he didn't step forward. Right? So there was a price for it. Which basically points out that any single quality is going to have its strengths and weaknesses. Right? It's not going to solve all the problems with it. Having one quality. Right? Of course, it also fits in the famous Medrash of Pinchas Eliyahu. Eliyahu is the other great Kanoi we find. How to take Pinchas Eliyahu is a machlokas in the Farshim, if it's meant, you know, as a, literally, which would then really guarantee had a long time, long life. And then Olam is okay, because Eliyahu doesn't really die, he goes up to heaven. So then Olam can become Olam again, right? Forever. Or Pinchas Eliyahu simply means that Eliyahu continues, as Rishon Frohr Hirsch says, that Eliyahu is a continuation of the quality of Pinchas. But the Kanoi, even in Eliyahu, if you recall, when he gets his divine vision, he's told that don't find Hashem in the Rash or in the Eish, don't find the great noise and the thunder and the lightning, but in the Kodesh Mamadaka. You gotta. Even Eliyahu is told to calm down, right? It's a quiet, still voice. You don't really hear God in the action, in the excitement, if you associate. Hard to imagine the Kanoi with the Kodesh Mamadaka. The very quiet Kanoi, silent. I don't mean a silent assassin either. Then the question is, what was the bris of Kuhunas Olam? So Kuhunas Olam either could mean that he became, that he had not yet been given kahuna because he was born before Aaron and his sons were told their descendants, meaning their future descendants, will get kahuna. So therefore he fell between the cracks, so to speak, and had to be given kahuna separately. Or kahuna olam refers to he and his descendants always being Kohen Gadol, which is the kahunas olam. Or it simply refers to the fact that he is given a very long life. Right? That's the Kohen, but he's going to be a Kohen for a very long time, since Olam doesn't always mean forever, but can mean a very long time in Hebrew. All right, so Pinchas is one kind of a leader of the Jewish people. But he's not the ultimate leader, because we have later in the parasha where Moshe's successor is chosen. And here we find some unusual terminology. Guess that the selection of Yahushua as Moshe's successor is not a tremendous surprise, right? Because we have, when Moshe gives, at the time in Bahaloscha, when the Jews start complaining and Moshe just can't handle it anymore, And Hashem says, we'll pick, he'll give you 70 chachamim to aid you. And Eldad and Medad are misnabe betel chamachene. The 70 came out of 72 because the 12 shvatim, each one got 6 and 2 were left out. Or they were really left out, or they were modest and allowed other people to take their places. It's separate, not our issue now. But they are prophesying in the camp. So Yehoshua, right, who's Moshe's right hand, Vayaret Hanavi Agila Moshe, right? Vayomer Yehoshua binun Mesharis Moshe, Vibchura, Vayomer Adoni Moshe, Kohen. Yehoshua binun is the one who serves Moshe, the one he's chosen. We had it even earlier in the war against Amalek. That's true, Aaron and Hur upheld Moshe's hands, but Yeshua was the actually fought the war for Moshe. So Yeshua is not such a surprising selection as the successor. Nevertheless, there's some interesting components here. First of all, how Hashem is referred to. Right? Vaydaber Moshe el Hashem leimor yifkod Hashem elokei haruchos lechol basar isha la'edo. Which quality of God is referred to? Elokei haruchos lechol basar. Not a common phrase. It appears how many other times in the Chumash? Once. Right? We think we use one of the phrases, we're saying Kadosh Baruch, that appears many times. He's God of the winds, Ruchos doesn't always mean wind, of the Chol Basar, of all kinds of people, understands all kinds of people. Where we find that phrase earlier, the one other time it appears in the Chumash, it's also in Sefer Bamidbar. What is the reference there? In Korach. But what content of Korach? Right. By Dav Hashem Moshe Aaron Leim, the Pesukim before, he bodl mitoch ha'edah zos v'achela osam kiroga. The word Eda Hazos is ambiguous. Eda Hazos could mean Korach and his followers. Eda Hazos could mean, unfortunately, everybody. So, Vayiplu apneim vayomru kel elokei haruchos lechol basar v'ish echad yecheta v'akol ha'edah tiktov. So, what is the response of Moshe Aaron? That God should only kill those who are guilty and not punish the entire Eidah, the entire Jewish people. And what term does Moshe and Aaron use refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this context? Hashem Elokei Haruchos Lechol Basar. And Rashi explains there in Korach, what is Elokei Haruchos Lechol Basar? That Kadosh Baruch Hu understands everyone, knows how to differentiate amongst people. In contrast to a human leader, who when there's a revolution, a revolt against them, doesn't know who's guilty and then kills indiscriminately, Kadosh Baruch Hu is capable of differentiation and knowing who to kill and who not to kill. So the phrase of Elokei Haruchos Lechol Basar means God who is capable and of knowing and differentiating amongst different kinds of people, understanding all kinds of people. Now let's go back to Pinchas. And what is the term used to describe Yehoshua? Vayom Hashem Moshe, kach luches Yehoshua bin Nun, ish asher ruach bo. We find the word ruach repeated here. Okay? Hashem Elokei Haruchos Lechol Basar. Ish Asher Ruach Bo. An interesting title. Should have said, You know Yahushua. He's your Mishores. He's your closest associate. Why is he referred to as Ruach? What's the kind of Ruach? Let me suggest something very interesting. Again with Ruach. Parsha the Shlach, the Meraglim. Right? In the Meraglim, there's an interesting contrast between Yehoshua and Caleb. We're accustomed to see the story of the Meraglim is simply 10 against 2. Right? 10 of the Meraglim say, we can't do it, they're too strong for us, forget it, let's not try even. And the two are the defenders, right? Kalev and Yehoshua. But actually, if we read it carefully, we find that Kalev plays a much more significant role than Yehoshua. Kalev steps forward initially by himself, and then Yehoshua joins him. And when they get rewarded, again, it's Kalei first, and then the two of them together. So Rashi says that the reason it was done that way was not because there's any difference between Kalei and Yehoshua, but Yeshua's words were going to be discounted. Everybody knew that Yehoshua was the disciple of Moshe, so what do you expect Yehoshua to say? He's going to support Moshe. Kalev was the surprise. Kalev was not to be expected. They assumed Kalev was on their side, and therefore his taking a strong position was much more effective. That's how Rashi interprets it. But there are other ways of seeing it. One of the other ways of seeing it is saying that there's a difference in the response between Kalev and Yehoshua. And that relates to a slight variation as how Kalev is described. Alright? One second. When it comes to Kalev, V'avdi perek yudalet pasach chavdalet, V'avdi Kalev ekev hoiso ruach acheres imo, V'yimalei acharoi. Right? These are arts. Asher bo Hashem v'zara yorishen. Interesting, we find the word ruach referring to Kalev, but in contrast to Yehoshua, it's ruach acher. Right? It's an additional word. Right? Ruach acher is, he had a different spirit than everybody else, but perhaps it means something else. Now, the pshat I'm going to give is not my own. It's not even first-hand, it's second-hand. I heard it from Rabbi Shulman, who said it over the name of Rabbi Meidan. So it's two steps removed from the person who said it. But it's an interesting shot. So if you look at the psukim, you find that Kalev takes the people on, and Yeshua doesn't seem to say anything initially. And it's only when the people go so far as to say, first, the people say it's too hard. We're afraid of them. Kalev responds. Kalev responds. All right? And then the people say, Yeshua tears his clothes, doesn't say anything. Right? I'm sorry, no. That's later. First, Kalev responds, then in Perak Yudalid, but he saw Kalaeda Vinu as Kalam Yifku Ambalaila Hu, Vilonu Amosha Balaran Kopene Israel, Vayomele and Kalaeda Lu Masnu Vetan Slam of Bibrazelu Masnu Mamasha Vyason Retazos, etc., etc. And ending up with Nitna Rosh from the Shuva Mitzrayim. The Jews, people of the time, go from being afraid to conquer Israel to the other extreme. They're angry at Moshe and Aaron. They said, why'd you do this? Why'd you take us out of Egypt? Let's go back to Egypt. Going back to Egypt means forget everything. Drop everything we've done. Right? Let's go back. Right? A total reversal. And then Yehoshua joins Kalev. So So Rabbi Midan suggests Ruach Acheres refers to the person who is not swayed by the crowds, stands up for his principles, he has a different Ruach, a different spirit, doesn't give in to what people want, and that's an extremely important quality. But being opposite to the people does not lend itself to be the leader of the people. It's absolutely necessary that someone has to stand up and fight and be on the other side on principle, but a leader has to understand the people and be supportive and more sensitive to them if he wants to bring them along. You don't bring people along by standing in total opposition. So Yehoshua initially is quiet. Even though he also disagrees with Meraglim, he doesn't want to create a total conflict. Quiet, maybe there's a way of working it out. It's when they cross the line, the ultimate line, when they say, when they sleep on it, right? Get up, and they get up and say, that night, you know, politically, they think about it and they go worse. Instead of calming down, instead of being responsive to the words of Kalev and rethinking, they go to the other extreme and they get so caught up in their rebellion that they say, no more Moshe Aaron, let's go back to Egypt, let's drop everything, that Yehoshua then steps forward. Because even a leader who is more accommodating knows there are red lines. When they cross the red lines, then you have to step forward. So the leader has Ruach, but not necessarily Ruach Acheres. Right? The leader has to understand people, be sympathetic to them even when they are weak and they don't go as far as they should go. But at the same time, he's not an oppositional figure like Kalev, but one who tries to work with the people as long as possible, and only when absolutely necessary has to draw the line. So the contrast is then reflected between Yehoshua, who becomes the permanent leader, and Kalev, who is a leader, but not the same kind of leader as Yehoshua. And if we look at it, by the way, it also will reflect not just the contrast between Yehoshua and Kalev, but also be the contrast between Yehoshua and Pinchas as well. Pinchas is the Kanoi, he gets Brisku Nasa Olam, but he's not the leader of the Jewish people. Yehoshua is the leader of the entire Jewish people, because in a similar fashion, the Kanoi, as wonderful as it may be at the right occasion, cannot be a permanent policy for leadership. If it's a permanent policy of being kanoi all the time, it's going to be destructive. It's a quality that has to be used only when absolutely necessary. In that regard, I like to quote Rebbe Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, commented on the Yigimel Midas HaRachamim. Then the Yigimel Midas HaRachamim, if one looks at the Pasuk, it stops in the middle of the Pasuk. The 13 divine attributes of mercy are mentioned and in a Pasuk that continues with V'nakei Lo Yinakei, you know, the second half of that Pasuk. Pokeinu V'nabos Avonim HaShem V'aribayim. The Pasuk doesn't end simply with the positive quality that also mentions sometimes God is angry, and sometimes God doesn't forgive. Sometimes he uses Midas HaDin. And Rav Aaron Zatzal pointed out that there are qualities that are to be used in an everyday normal. That's the way to function. Some qualities that have to be brought out when absolutely necessary, but they're volatile and dangerous and not to be used regularly. So there's the Midas HaRachamim, those are the Midas that are to be used all the time. That's how we're supposed to function, the Midas HaRachamim. And then the Midas HaDin, the Kanoah, is Kel Kanoah Hashem also. Hashem is also Kel Kanoah, a jealous God. But that quality has to be used sparingly and only the right occasions. Because if used too often, that means everything will be destroyed. So Pinchas reflects the quality of the kel kana, of the kanos, which is both moderated with shalom, according to one interpretation we gave before, and also is one that is needed when needed, but very dangerous, and has to come only from the purest of motives, and when used too often can become dangerous. Yehoshua represents ruach, not ruach acheres of kalev, more balanced personality who knows when to get angry at the people and when to go positively. And then following the norm of leading them in a positive fashion and only showing the midas hadin, the quality of strict demands of justice when absolutely necessary, in a more limited, controlled fashion. All right? We will then move, now we've got to get to some very interesting women. Right? It's nice Slavka. And before we try to analyze it, I just want to quote. One second. I have my little thing, which I here it is. The Gemara in Bava Basra, Daf Kuf Yud Tes Amid Beis, refers to three qualities of the Bnos Slavcha. They were Chachmonios, they were wise. Darshanios, they knew how to speak. Right? All right, they knew how to interpret things and to speak intelligently. Not everybody wise is a good speaker. And third, they were tzitkanios, they were righteous. Now, why did the Chazal give them these three qualities? So, what is the story of Noslavka, which begins in this week's, in the parsha of Pinchas, that ends at the end of Sefer Bamidbar? They come to Moshe with the following complaint. The laws of inheritance, as described, has been described as going just to it, goes from father to son. Daughters don't inherit. Their father, Slavchad, had only daughters. Only daughters, who's going to inherit him? There are no sons. I mean, he's going to go to his brothers. His family's going to lose out. So they said, why should we lose out at this opportunity to have a share in Eretz Israel? Now, the Gemara says they were very wise because it turns out, according to various calculations, the Gemara Bava Basra, which are too complicated for me to repeat now, there are different ways they could have gotten shares, and they might have gotten some share and not a full share, what they would have gotten if they inherited. Whether they get shares on their own, whether they get shares through their father, it's a whole bunch of calculations of the Gemara Bava Basra. So we're obviously aware of all the ramifications. Now we know the phrase that they use also shows their wisdom. Because we find Loma Yigarashem Ravin Mitoch Mishpach Tokin Lo Ben. So first of all, they use the word Loma Yigara. Why should they lose out? Will we find that previously in a case where Moshe couldn't answer? Pesach Sheni, right? Putting it in context of desire to do a mitzvah. Just like in Pesach Sheni, people say, why should we lose out? And we won't be able to give, to bring a Korban Pesach, because we were Tomei at the time. Give us a chance to fulfill the mitzvah. So they put it in similar terms. Why should it be lost out to lose the mitzvah of settling and being part of being a Yarish of Eretz Yisrael, right, and having a share in the land of Israel? But they're also wise in another way. Right? They don't say, why should we lose out? They don't say, it's tough. Why don't we get our share? Because it's because of God we should lose out. Lama yigara shem avinu mitoch mishpachta. Why should our father's memory be blotted out from the family Yerusha? Right? Because if it's given to our father's brothers, so there will be no line reflecting our father. Why should he lose out? Right? They were wise enough not to put it only in terms of themselves, but in terms of their father's memory. Right? They knew how to say it. Maybe it's by the Darshani also. They knew how to express it in such a way not to appear as self or saying, we're losing out, but rather our father's memory. Nothing's going to remain from Sofra. His share is going to be given away to others. We'll marry other people, and nothing will remain from his descendants. Why are they described as tzidkoniyos? How they show their righteousness? Well, that's really more what's going to be said in Parshas Masa at the end of the end of it. Because while they have a complaint, the Shevet has a complaint as well. Right? The Shevet's complaint is, what's going to happen? The daughters of Tzlofgad are going to inherit their father's land as part and parcel of Menashe's property, right? Because they're part of Menashe. What's going to happen? They're going to get married. When they get married, it's going to go over to the family, to their husbands. We'll say you wish the Baal's Midrabanan, so their husbands, their children. Their children won't be necessarily from Shevet Menashe, because they can marry anybody they want to marry. There's no restrictions. Jewish people are not restricted. They can marry only within their Shevet. They're going to marry whoever they want to marry. Their children will not necessarily be from our Shevet. So the same, a similar argument to why should Tzlofgad and his descendants lose out, why should Shevet Menashe lose out? The whole Shevet's going to lose. So they, Moshe says, you're right. Moshe's always very agreeable. You're right. He says, well, Tzlofgad, you're right. Says, that's right, they have to marry people from their Shevet, which the Chazal says only applied in that generation. There was a restriction that for all intents and purposes applied only to them. And they were tzidkoniyos, and they accepted it. Right? They accepted the fact that while they will inherit in the memory of their father, but they are going to pay a price in terms of whom they're able to marry. Because they're going to be restricted to marry within the framework of the families of the Shevet Menashe, instead of having the opportunity to marry anyone that they please. So therefore they are chachmonios, they're wise in how they present their case, they're dashonios, they know how to speak, how to say it, how to deal. They're not frightened to come and speak to Moshe Rabbeinu. Express themselves well, and the tzidkoniyos, because they are willing to accept the price they get, right? That there's a price they get. It's not just pure sheva, right? Pure reward. Well, you know, they could have said, if that's the case, then we won't marry.
Right? They were an exception.
Okay, that's the Gemara. Pasht
right,
the
Gemara. So that's really the kind of
Right. If you accept the Gemara that says that it didn't apply to them, they did it voluntarily, then it's even the bigger tzidkoniyos. So, it's very interesting because not only to say the qualities, but what's particularly impressive, of course, is that there were five of them. And they all worked in concert the entire time. Right? We know to get people to work together is not always so easy, right? And it's interesting that even when the names are mentioned at different times, the order shifts. The shift in order, one according to their age, one according to their wisdom, But when you find shifts of order, remember back to early in Sefer Shmos, when we find in the era reference to Hu Moshe Ba'aron, Aron Moshe, the Rashi says that when you say the names in different order of the two brothers, it's a sign that they're equal. Right? It's also a sign of working harmoniously together. So here also one can assume that the fact that their names are said in different order, in different different times in the Torah, is a reflection of their working together and their equality. Right? They're working as a united kind of team. So to review, because I'm accustomed to the 50-minute hour. And I also have to leave for a wedding. That's another factor. What we saw, the parts of the parsha that we tried to analyze, had to do with Jewish leadership and people emerging from the general populace. Started off with Pinchas, and Pinchas the Kanoi, the question of how wonderful Kanoias is. The Psukim seem to say that his Kanoias was save the day. The Gemara mentions the Chacham were not happy with it, Rabbetzon Chachamim, implying that Kanoias is only acceptable when it's purely the Shem Shemayim, when there's no other motivation, and that it's very powerful and dangerous. What are his rewards? He gets peace, which either means that the people he killed are not going to, their family's not going to come back to get him, or he's going to be given the quality of peace to balance his kanoes. He then gets kunas olam, which according to Rashi means he and his family become kohanim, which they weren't beforehand because of this anomaly, or it means that they're going to become the kohanim gedolim, the high priests, all the generations. Or it's going to refer to his longevity, because we know that according to Chazal, and also it's implied in Shur and Shoftim, he lived a very, very long time, an abnormally long time. Right? Then we go to the leadership of Yahushua, where the Torah stresses what quality of Yahushua, that he has Ruach, and refers to what quality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Elokei Ruchos Lechol Basar, God who understands different people. And a person with Ruach apparently has that quality of understanding different people. And to be a proper leader, one has to be able to understand that people are different. You can't lead by lumping everybody together and just demanding that everybody function the same way. It's only if you understand human nature and how to deal with different kinds of people that you can be a fully leader. And then we contrasted the Ruach, the word Ruach, respect to Yahushua, with Ruach Acheres, referring to Kalev, the name of Rabbi Meidan, Nurashiv in Gush, where Ruach Acheres seems to refer to someone who's in opposition to everyone else, to the ability, which is critical ability, to be able to stand up to the crowd and stand up for principle, even though everybody's on the other side. But Ruach Acheres, what a critical quality, is not necessarily a quality that's going to enable one to lead people with them. It's going to fight the battle, but it's not going to be the leadership because it's always done in opposition. While Yahushua has the Ruach, is who waits and tries to work with the people, and only when they cross the red line and go too far does he join Kalev and have to take a hard stance against it. Shows a greater sensitivity to the complexity of human beings and a desire to bring them along rather than to always just stand in opposition, even when the opposition is correct. And we concluded to the Gnos Slavchot, who demonstrate their wisdom, their ability to express themselves properly. Darshanios is not used in the negative sense of someone who talks too much. Darshanias is used in the sense of someone who can express well, who know how to express in the right way to accomplish the goal, and the Tzidkonios in their righteousness, and that their goal, again, is L'shem Shemayim, and their willingness to sacrifice and to marry their relatives, which in effect means that the inheritance is theirs, but it's not fully theirs. I mean, because in the end, since the next generation will be seen in terms of their husband, so their Safrad's memory is preserved in one generation strongly, but subsequently rather minimally, to put it mildly, because they'll be seen as their, you know, in terms of their fathers and grandfathers, not in terms of their mothers and grandfathers. It'll still be there, but it'll be there in a reduced capacity. And they reflect all these three wonderful qualities, which I assume would be appropriate qualities for leaders in general, to be chachamim, darshanim, and tzaddikim.
Thank you, Rav Lau, for the wonderful shiur. And I'd like to thank everybody for coming, and also all of the sponsors and all of the volunteers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for organizing everything. Thank you.